For nearly 20 centuries, Western civilization has been constructing a pseudoscience called theology. The word means literally knowledge of God, even though many theologians declare that God is unknowable. This pseudoscience has been taken seriously enough by enough people to evolve a mainstream morality, to shape the spiritual lives of millions of human beings, to foment innumerable wars, persecutions, and crusades, to support the civilized world's richest and most powerful institutions, and not incidentally, to create a patriarchal society that is fundamentally misogynist and sexist. During the patriarchal centuries, a majority of Western women certainly accepted the belief systems of theology because there were no alternatives available to them. Indeed, in some periods of history, not to accept the patriarchal God was a capital crime, to be punished even more severely than murder. Within the system, many women even managed to think themselves emancipated. Nevertheless, any system that views a female as something less than a male, that denigrates her as a source of temptation, sin, or guilt, that denies her full participation in religious leadership, and that postulates a god without a goddess, is not only sexist to the core, it is the core of sexism. Patriarchal religion creates misogyny and was and is the primary medium of women's spiritual, political, and social enslavement. There is no other aspect of human nature or culture that could have evolved such a phenomenon, writes my guest, Barbara G. Walker, in her recent book, Restoring the Goddess. Barbara Walker is a renowned feminist scholar and prolific author of many books, including The Crone and the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Rituals. After graduating magna cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania, Barbara married, and as a lifelong scholar, soon began her 25 years of collecting notes for her monumental Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, 1,123 pages, published in 1983 and still in print. Meanwhile, at the age of 35, she taught herself to knit and began to collect and invent new pattern stitches. Her knitting books, still in print, are considered primary sources for professional designers. After publication of her encyclopedia, Barbara wrote books on related subjects such as rituals, mythology, symbolism, tarot, I Ching, pre-Christian religions, one novel, a collection of original feminist fairy tales, an autobiography, and others. She also created 78 paintings for the Barbara Walker Tarot Deck and 64 paintings for her I Ching series. She also wrote her own book of sacred stones, Fact and Fallacy in the Crystal World. Her books have been translated into 6 languages and enjoy brisk sales. In 1993, she received the Humanist Heroine of the Year Award from the American Humanist Association. In 1995, received the Women Making Her Story Award from the New Jersey Now. She takes step aerobics classes 5 days a week. And in 2002, the Walkers celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. In April of this year, the Unitarian Universalist Association gave Barbara the Olympia Brown Award in recognition of the significant recent efforts on behalf of achieving a non-sexist society. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Janie.
Thank you for being here and for your monumental work of uncovering the past and writing boldly about it.
Well, it's been a pleasure. A pleasure and a pain at the same time, I think. They say the goddess drives. I think she drives me very hard.
It's clear that she does. But your work is critically important, it seems, at this juncture of history.
Well, I can read a little bit, which might introduce the subject to women who are not familiar with it.
Please do.
If we go back to the very beginning, the human species is almost 3 million years old, a very recent life form on a planet where other forms first began to appear 2 billion years ago. And even among humans, patriarchy is the most recent of social systems. having existed in anything like a currently recognizable form only for about 5,000 years at the most. Perhaps 1/600th of the time that humans have lived on Earth. Patriarchy, with its social system and its exclusively male gods, are only the newest products of a mere tick in geologic time. Like other mammals, early humans knew only one parent, the mother. Paleolithic groups were based on mother relationships. Tribes were composed of female ancestresses, their children, and their siblings. We have the concept of fatherhood non-existent and children belonging to their mothers. All humans believed that the life-giving power was a gift from the creative goddess. Female ancestors were deified, and with the passage of generations, sexuality was not a religious issue because nobody knew that children were begotten as well as conceived. There was no monogamy. So when we picture that caveman dragging his mate into a cave and bullying his children, we have a very apocryphal view of the Paleolithic human. There was no caveman with one mate and several children. Sexual affairs were probably very brief and not considered part of the family. The immediate relatives of any man were his mother and his siblings and his sister's children, which all took part in the matrilineal clan. So we have a very recent phenomenon here in patriarchy, even though we are taught to believe that it came from long ago.
It's good to clarify things and understand how they really were. You speak of theology, and you have another word.
Theology. Well, theology is a word that comes from Greek, and it means knowledge of God, which is, of course, an oxymoron because the theologians say God is unknowable. But theology, with an A, T-H-E-A-L-O-G, would be knowledge of goddess. And I think that every woman deep down inside has knowledge of goddess. Because after all, our deities are created out of our own imaginations. And goddess is a metaphor for nature, Mother Earth, the life force, all that good stuff. And I think it serves a lot better as a metaphor for those things than a male god.
Right.
We have one of the holiest images in ancient paganism, a figure of the goddess giving birth, a very explicit depiction of a child emerging from its mother's body. And, of course, to patriarchal societies such as early Christians, such an image was the ultimate obscenity. To see a woman in the act of giving life still considered unfit for the eyes of children. Whereas on television and movies, to see a man in the act of taking life is a daily occurrence for every one of our children in this media-centered society, which is really too bad.
Indeed it is.
Also, we have a society now in which our patriarchy has run away with us and created a very dangerous culture. For example, imagine a world in which any woman or child might walk alone on any street or back alley or lonely road or woods path or waterfront or any other place at any hour of the day or night and encounter a strange man or men without even a momentary sense of threat. That would be a civilized world. We do not have a civilization because we are actually so savage that we can't easily envision this. Women and children in this culture have to learn that every man must be feared until he's proven innocuous. And we've come to a terrible pass when when all men must be routinely suspected of criminal, sadistic, or homicidal tendencies. The male violence occurring daily in American cities and towns is encouraged by the violent fantasy world shown in the male-dominated entertainment industry.
And
television and movies incessantly present women being terrorized or raped or beaten or murdered by men, and this primary means of acculturization pretends to be entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that boggles my mind.
Yes, it's horrifying.
We must distinguish between patriarchy and men. It is the patriarchal culture, and there are women who are patriarchal.
In Chapter 4, you define a patriarchy. I wonder, should I run through those? There are about 4 paragraphs of it.
Sure, feel free to quote.
I love your words. A patriarchy is a society where the moral and ethical codes have been created by men, with women having little or no voice in the process. Men are the primary lawmakers and religious authorities. Men govern and define the theology. Patriarchal men control most of the money and property, earn more than women, demand attention from women and children more often than they give it, develop rigid sexual attitudes, and regard many forms of intimidation as permissible. Often there is considerable bigotry and intolerance. Paradoxically, in a patriarchy, men also do most of the law-breaking, especially crimes of violence, which in our country runs more than 90% male. When women become violent, more than half the time it is in retaliation against men who have abused them. Our male-dominated culture has a horrifyingly high incidence of father-daughter and father-son sexual abuse, father-child abuse, wife beating, and rape. The most recent figures state that in America, a woman is raped every 4 minutes. Nothing in patriarchal religious or moral standards provides much more than lip service to combating such oppressions. Frequently, the oppression itself is simply glossed over with a euphemism, as when wife beating is officially described as domestic disputes. Patriarchies are also typically warlike. Their religions may preach peace, but whenever there is a war to be fought, their gods are right in there leading the charge on the battlefield. There is little recognition for the majority opinion of women who gave birth and understand the long years of care and nurturing that go into the formation of each human life. To be able to snuff out life, human or otherwise, with satisfying swiftness is to many men the ultimate power trip. It is a godlike power.
Yes, and the goddess-like power of giving life is being belittled, I'm afraid, in our culture. Genevieve Vaughn writes, quote, "Nurturing is the origin of our species, not competition and hierarchy or the survival of the fittest. Human mothers ensure the survival of the unfittest, infants. True human lives are created by the long, arduous, many-faceted processes of mothering. What mother could look into the face of her baby and reflect that God hates this child who is really a demon?" And that was what the church called them. Any child before baptism was demonic, and the whole rite of baptism was an exorcism of the demon, which is the child.
It's a pretty awful time.
Yes. When we are talking of goddess lore, of course, we have to go back to paganism, because it was the pagan culture that revered the goddess all the way up in well into the Middle Ages and beyond. And the church, of course, was very much opposed to that, and described the ancient priestesses as witches, and of course we all know what the Inquisition did about that. 9 million women slaughtered, tortured, and burned over the course of about 500 years. It was the worst Holocaust Europe had ever seen.
in their hearts, many women feel that there is something terribly wrong with our system. They yearn to be a tribe. They yearn to keep their children near them, to watch their children's children develop through their own generations as an ongoing community of life. Male psychologists label such maternal feelings over-possessive, but animal behavior suggests that they are more natural than the separations and isolations that cause so much of our cultural anxiety. Women know it's wrong to break up families. They know that people generally have deep needs for the stability to be found in related groups who have known each other from birth. Women especially yearn not to see their sons go away to war, where they stand a fair chance of being maimed or killed. War has killed at least 100 million people since the turn of the 20th century. Responsibility for this slaughter rests on men, not women. No right-to-life scruples seem to deter men from exterminating full-grown human beings, often on a very large scale. And the men who do this continue to worship the God who allegedly condones and supports their efforts, even when both sides of the conflict have the same God. Thus the Heavenly Father looks rather like one of the more bloodthirsty Roman emperors sitting back to watch his gladiators butcher one another. And you said, if human beings could see themselves as children of one great mother, as they once did, perhaps members of the human family could become more like siblings together. Something like this should happen soon before patriarchy brings about the destruction of our entire species and our planet itself.
Yes, it's been very wasteful in the use of natural resources as well. We throw away so much on our wars and our aggressions, which could be used to improve life, the quality of life for all people. It's a shame.
Oh, it's horrific. It's, we're watching it happen around us and seemingly helpless to make a difference.
I wrote an autobiography which is called The Skeptical Feminist, and in that I wrote about how I first turned against the whole idea of the God, and it was when, in my childhood, when I had a beloved dog who died, and I asked the minister to tell me how I could meet my dog again in heaven, and he said that dogs are not allowed in heaven because they have no souls, so I would never see my dog again, and I was so crushed, and he said that I would see all my relatives and loved ones, and I thought maybe I could negotiate. I could trade a couple of aunts and uncles for my dog. But he said, no, that would not be possible. And I just threw a tantrum, although I wasn't prone to doing that. I said, I don't want anything to do with that nasty old God and his tiresome old heaven. And I ran away crying. Yeah. And my mother was mortified, and it was just a horrible occurrence, but it started me thinking. I figured if soul is a manifestation of love, then certainly animals are just as capable of it as we are, and maybe more so, because our pets love us unconditionally.
Yes, and, they do.
So it was the dog who really gave me the initial impulse.
Isn't that interesting? Well, your book, The Skeptical Feminist, is one of my very favorites. It's packed full.
Well, thank you. That's yes. Very nice.
In fact, it's the first feminist writing I had ever read.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes, and I was in the depth of my own spiritual journey, which was awakening to the mother within. But I didn't have anything outside me. It was just me. So it's a very frightening place I really was in. And yet I must had to carry on with what I was doing, but then your book came into my hands, and there it was. It wasn't a figment of my imagination, which I knew it wasn't, of course. It was real.
Well, they say that when you're ready, something comes.
That's right.
True of most of us.
We're going to take a phone call here. Is that okay? You ready?
Sure.
All right. Hello there. You're on Women's Voices.
Hi. Thanks for the show.
You're welcome.
I wanted to say that I believe that the Inquisition is alive and well, and that's obvious in how many women are brutally beaten and murdered in our culture. And recently, a young African-American lesbian in Newark, New Jersey, was brutally murdered. That fact has received very little press. Very few of us know about her murder. And I'd like to say that I think lesbian culture, such an important part of women worship, lesbian culture is so feared and detested in our mainstream culture, in part by virtue of the fact that women loving women reflects a female appreciation, worship, and orientation that I think links back to the goddess in each of us, and in part results in our turning our backs on the patriarchy in a really positive way. Just a comment, and I'd like to hear your comments on that, and I'll take them off the air. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The lesbian community has been put down more than any other, even more than male gay people. However, I'm not sure that I would call it an inquisition. The violence against women has been endemic throughout this culture. I mean, we have husbands beating up wives regularly. We have fathers sodomizing children. But the organized violence that the Inquisition represented is still underground. We have an organization, or the Catholic Church has an organization now called Opus Dei, which means the work of God, and they've recently built a $45 million center in New York City, and they have a lot of money, and they're very fanatical. And, of course, the church still has the office of inquisitor officially, so they can reactivate the Inquisition anytime they feel like it. This, of course, is the organized part of the violent, religious violence. And, yes, it's still around, and, yes, we need to fear it because it could come back. We also have fundamentalist fanatics of all stripes who are violent. We have people bombing abortion clinics. We have people attacking lesbian communities, as you say, murdering lesbians occasionally. There's all kinds of patriarchal fanaticism out there, and it is very scary. And I think we definitely need to crack down on this kind of behavior and this kind of attitude. And change must come about from the grassroots first. And then the politicians will begin to listen because they have a lot of voters thinking a new way. Then they have to listen.
Well, you know, we're talking about what's going on in this country, but in reality, women are suffering terribly all over the world.
Yes, especially in Muslim countries.
Oh, yes, who simply have no authority over their own body at all. And then you think of all the sexual slavery in many, many countries of children and women that is horrific, and this is not talked about. It's ignored.
When I lived in a different area of the country, I knew a woman who worked as a nurse in a local hospital where there was a strong Muslim community. And she said women would come in with these botched clitoridectomies, the so-called female circumcision, and they would have horrible infections and horrible mutilations. And she was trying to report these mutilations to the police, and the police were saying, well, it's a religious issue, so we can't do anything about it. It's not a crime, you know. It's their religion. Women who had to put up with that kind of religion are having a very hard time.
It's awful. It's simply awful that they have no one to stand beside them.
Yes, and they have not a clue that there used to be something different, even in their home countries. Arabia, pre-Islam, worshipped a goddess by the name of Alat, which means the goddess, Allah meaning the god. And they had a matrilineal society, and some of the Berbers and other Arabic tribes still have customs of matrilineal. So it does go way back in practically every culture you can
Well,
we just need to learn our history.
That's exactly right, and that's why your writing is very important. And it needs to be talked about. You never hear anything about our history on the radio, seldom in writing. It just doesn't happen.
No, the media tend to ignore it because they figure it's not a popular issue.
There was a ruling passed a law in 1991 by Revolutionary Command Council. I guess that's out now. But the Quran says that any disobedient woman must be scourged and sent to beds apart, and any wife, mother, daughter, sister, aunt, niece, or female cousin may be killed with impunity by any man who believes her guilty of adultery.
Well, this is what patriarchy does to insist on fatherhood. As long as they could control women's sexuality and reproduction, they could make themselves the rulers of the children.
Mm-hmm.
This was very important. I mean, it says in the Bible that any bride who is found not to be a virgin on her wedding night must be killed. I mean, this is God's rule right there in Holy Writ. It's not followed, of course. I mean, there are people pick and choose what they want to do out of Holy Writ, but that's God's law. And I assume that in biblical times it was certainly done.
They
want to make sure that the offspring is the offspring of the male.
And they dare to do anything to ensure that. That's the part where they think God supports them, I guess. So, you know, we all know it's not okay to kill. We all know that in our deepest heart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing how that's been overwritten.
Right.
Pope John Paul II's response to the mass rapes of women in Bosnia was not to back those who are today working to have mass rapes finally recognized as war crimes. Rather, it was to pray that the violated women not have abortions.
And who took care of the resulting children? One wonders.
Yeah. Yep.
Who, for that matter, takes care of the children who are born to very young teenagers or very poor women or women who have 9 children already? The Pope addressed a crowd in South America recently. I read this in the news, and spoke to all these peasant women who have 10, 11, 12 children and are worn out with childbearing, and he tells them that birth control is a mortal sin. Now, this happened, 3 or 4 years ago? And these poor people are listening to this and thinking, oh, well, this is the Holy Father. He has the word. He's absolutely, anything he says is true. So, you know, the abuse is going on and on.
Yes.
And it's being done under the auspices of religion, which is, of course, the source of sexism anyway.
Thank you very much, Barbara, for being here. Talking. It's been wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Janie.
In her book, Sacred Pleasure, in the chapter entitled Making Love or Making War, Dr. Rhianne Eisler writes, "The war of the sexes is a metaphor for what has been an incredibly violent war against women, a war in which the casualties are far higher than in many well-publicized armed conflicts. For example, in the United States, more women were victims of rape in 1989, 1 year alone, than Marines wounded in all of World War II. In 1990, the U.S. Surgeon General reported that domestic violence was the single largest cause of injury to American women. The FBI announced that 3 out of 4 American women can expect to be the target of at least one crime of violence in their lifetime. And in other parts of the globe, the incidence of violence against women is no doubt even higher. The tragic truth is that if violence against girls and women and little boys, I add, were considered newsworthy, it would make headlines every day and would have done so for most of recorded history. Rianne refers to Willis Harmon's book, Global Mind Change, in which he says that real progress can come only as people begin to awaken from the social trance that is in vital part produced by what we are today beginning to recognize as traditions of child abuse. And so I welcome back my guest, Rianne Eisler, grandmother, visionary, scholar, international speaker, and author of many books, including The Chalice and the Blade, Power of Partnership, and Sacred Pleasure, and who is a tireless worker in her efforts to awaken the world to the chains that bind us. Welcome, Rianne.
It's good to be with you again, Janie, as always.
Thank you. It's powerful stuff we are dealing with.
Yes, it is. And our challenge, really, is to bring these issues to the center of the social and political agenda. And in many ways, worldwide, being pushed backward. Yeah. And that's all the more reason why I not only write and speak, but also work on initiatives that where groups of people and individuals can get involved. And one of these is the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence. Without addressing those issues, we really cannot speak of a world of peace with any reality. And of course, we should address that issue to begin with because of the horrible damage that it does and the lives it takes. Millions of women and children. We have a job, don't we?
Yes, we certainly do. I'd like to ask you a question before we pick up from where we left off last month. Jane Fonda recently made a speech at the National Women's Leadership Summit. I quote just a bit from it. Just because patriarchy has ruled for 10,000 years since the beginning of agriculture doesn't make it inevitable. Maybe at some earlier stage in human evolution, patriarchy was what was needed just for the species to survive. I think part of that is misinformation, and I have two questions for you. First of all, we certainly don't know our history has fallen through the cracks, and I think it's important that we do know it. Is the advent of agriculture and dominator rule connected?
Well, you know, that's the conventional story. Unfortunately, it is really believed by many people, yeah. including apparently Jane, which is a shame because there is a great deal of evidence indicating that that's just not true. There is a very great amount of data, both from archaeology and from ancient myths, that tell us, no, that that was not the case, that during the first agricultural times, there were many societies, and particularly in the mainstream of civilization worldwide, that still oriented more to what I call a partnership rather than a domination model. And of course, patriarchy is very much of a domination model. We're beginning with the ranking of the male half of humanity over the other half. The primary principle in the society is a power over these very nefarious, pathological kinds of relationships that are behind most of our world's problems. So that's wrong, and I'll just give you one example. The Neolithic site of Çatalhöyük, there's a great deal of evidence indicating that this site, which is about 8,000 years old, was agricultural, but that did not orient to what Jane calls patriarchy. Mm-hmm. Other examples from myth, for example, many, many, many stories, whether it's Isis, whether it's a Sumerian deity like Inanna, or, you know, Isis, of course, is Egyptian. They attribute the gift of agriculture to a female deity,
right,
to a goddess. But people choose to ignore this because we are still in this very 19th century model of this linear progression to ever more civilization. All we have to look at the world today, and it's not exactly civilized, is it?
And the other piece of that is that we didn't begin in patriarchy. We began with mother love, didn't we? I mean, that's how we survived.
Well, there's very, very strong evidence, again, that that's the case.
Yeah.
And it would make sense because this domination model is so, well, among other things, it's painful. I mean, the basic principle holding it together is not the mutual sharing that gives pleasure, whether it's sharing of food, whether it's sharing of love. Yes, these rankings of dominations, which are ultimately backed up by fear and force. And this other thing about when maybe patriarchy was necessary, this is, again, a very old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. As Margaret Mead once said, nothing is predetermined in evolution. In fact, it isn't just biological evolutionary theory, that just because something happened, it had to happen. There are choices, there are bifurcations, and I would submit that what we're finding out today, for example, in companies that move more towards the partnership end of the continuum than the domination end, when people feel cared for, when people are participating, when people aren't being controlled and coerced and frightened, they're far more creative and far more productive. It just makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
People come to life.
Of course.
So that whole notion that somehow in order to achieve, we had to have that system, these are dominator myths, and they maintain the system.
I feel like everyone in the world needs to read this book. I think it needs to be discussed in small groups, reading it aloud, poring over it. I cannot think of a thing we could do that would be more helpful to setting us on the path to liberation. It's terribly important.
Well, you know, there is actually a study guide called the, not to be confused with the Power of Partnership, but it's called the Partnership Way. And it's a study guide for both sacred pleasure and the chalice and the blade. And a lot of people have created groups using it. And it is available online. From partnershipway.org, which is the website of the Center for Partnership Studies.
I'd like to read a little bit, if I might, and from your book, and then I'll let you talk. Is that okay?
That's great.
As we said last time, psychohistorian Joe Berghold points out what happens to the psyche of an abused child is similar to what happens in a hypnotic trance. People in hypnotic trances are so influenced by another's suggestions or commands of what they should think, feel, and do that they suppress their own perceptions, feelings, and even will. But in the case of a chronically abusive childhood, this substitution of another's view of reality for one's own becomes habitual. Even one's own abuse, one's own pain, and one's own outrage at such injustice gradually becomes unreal, repressed into the deepest recesses of one's unconscious mind, or legitimized as the way things are supposed to be. Like Willis Harmon, Berghold believes that once we truly become conscious of how we have been acculturated, we can learn to transcend our conditioning. But his main point is that a history marked by submission to domination, manipulation, and exploitation can be explained in psychohistorical terms as the extension of that susceptibility from the personal to the larger political realm. There is ample evidence that people who grow up in families where rigid hierarchies and painful punishments are the norm learn to suppress anger toward their oppressors. There is also ample evidence that this anger then is also deflected against traditionally disempowered groups such as women, mothers, minorities, and children. Moreover, as the psychologist Elsa Frankel Brunswick documents in the classic work on the subject, The Authoritarian Personality, having been conditioned through childhood abuse to surrender their will to the requirements of a feared authoritarian parent. So such people also tend to be extremely susceptible as adults to surrender their will and minds to authoritarian leaders. And having been severely punished for any hint of rebellion as children, even talking back about being treated unfairly, they gradually also learn to deny to themselves that there was anything wrong with what was done to them as children, and in turn to do it to their own children. Further, this socialization operates not only on the mental and emotional level, it operates on the physical level of the body. And this is what Wilhelm Reich's work was about. In fact, it is on this bodily level that childhood conditioning is most effective and enduring, as it is here that authoritarian control is most traumatically experienced, of course, and the psychosomatic patterns required for the maintenance of dominator systems first become entrenched. And this is now my words. Obviously, being violated, battered, and raped as a child destroys one's trust in the universe, and that means living with constant underlying fear. This is why sexual abuse of children is key to maintaining this system. This is so much of my own work, you know.
I know.
Since I know, as a mother and student of psychology, that the baby, girl or boy, comes into the world with a heart full of love, clearly it is through abuse that this natural tendency toward love and compassion gets shifted. In spiritual terms, I would say this is where evil has gotten a toehold, through the sexual abuse of children, for it is devastating to the psyche, destroying self-confidence.
Well, I think that what we really have to address is that this is known. This has been documented. And yet, if you look at the progressive political agenda, this issue just isn't even... It isn't even there, is it?
You are listening to Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reasoner here with my guest, Rhianne Eisler. It simply doesn't seem to penetrate people's minds.
I know. Well, it doesn't penetrate for a number of reasons. One is very simple. You pick up any book, any political science textbook. You pick up the newspaper. In other words, it's not part of the conversation. And unfortunately, people are socialized by the conversations that they're taught, aren't we?
So we have to just get that conversation out. But there are also the very psychological reasons that you have, you know, that you've been reading about. And it's really a tremendous testimony to the human need to leave behind the domination system, to the human need for caring connection, yes, and the human need for freedom and for love and see an equality, that many people who are abused do not repeat the patterns. But unfortunately, a very significant number are of the type that we've been talking about. Well, they're so in denial because of what happened to them as children, and it was very unsafe for them to be anything other than that. So naturally, they tend to not only idealize the parents who inflicted pain on them, but they are attracted to that authoritarian, quote, strong leader. But they're also, in their politics, tend to be very punitive, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all about prisons and about vengeance against enemies. It's really a horrible tangle. So again, we've got to really change the conversation. And this is why I'm working on some actual on-the-ground initiatives. And I mentioned SAVE, the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence. And there are two things that distinguish it. One is that we show the link between intimate and national and international violence. But also, we're particularly working to engage religious leaders, because 80% of the world's people identify with a religious faith, and religious leaders have enormous moral authority, but tragically, they have not used it to condemn intimate violence. They've got problems, of course, because most of the world's traditions have some scripture or other that actually condones it and even commands it.
In your chapter, Bondage or Bonding, you mentioned Kathleen Berry's book, Female Sexual Slavery, where there are eyewitness accounts of modern slave auctions in part of Africa and Asia, where heavily drugged women, sometimes still dressed in the clothes they had on when abducted, are sold to the highest bidder. These sales often involve children. For example, a well-documented 1990 public auction in the slums of Karachi of girls from Bangladesh aged 8 to 10 was described at a 1991 conference on slavery. This is not new, of course, and it's also going on in this country. We just don't talk about it. Abducted children being auctioned off as sexual slaves or supplied for men's use at demonic rituals. You also point out there's a lack of official action against sexual slavery. There's an estimated million or more women or children every year traded like commodities on a stock exchange. I mean, what a commentary on our world.
Well, it's a horrible commentary. And again, the fact that at best this issue gets a feature story once every blue moon. But if we don't address the primary human relations, which are the relations between the female and male half of humanity, women and men, and between them and their daughters and sons, the relations where people first learn to either respect human rights or to accept human rights violations as just the way things are, whether they're happening in their particular family or not, by the way, whether if it's accepted in their culture or subculture, if we don't really change that, look, I mean, it's those relations model using force to impose your will on another if they're dominator relations, if there's intimate violence. So it's a school for terrorism. It's a school for warfare. It's a school for all kinds of use of force to gain your ends. Mm-hmm. We don't address these issues. We don't have foundations. I'm not saying that we don't have to deal with the other issues, but we really need to start thinking in more long-range terms. And the first step is changing the conversation.
Well, as you say, the sexual enslavement of women has historically and cross-culturally gone hand in hand with the political and economic enslavement of both men and women. You write, one of the main ways that destructive masculinity is maintained in dominator societies is precisely through the long-accepted and totally arbitrary notion that for a man to develop normally, he must learn not to identify with his mother. That the mark of masculinity is a man's separation from and rejection of any feminine identity. The prohibition against identifying and thus empathizing with his mother is a way of teaching a man not to feel soft or feminine emotions, and thus not to empathize with any woman, not even, in Theodore Roszak's words, the woman most desperately in need of liberation, the woman every man has locked up in the dungeons of his own psyche. As a young boy, he must, and I'm saying this, as a young boy, he must learn to deny his love and need for his own mother. Thus he cannot comfort himself. The myths such as Freud's Oedipus complex, which set up the angry sons to take over from an equally angry father, and in the process possess as many women as possible, including in fantasy even their own mothers, and Jungian type archetypes that still idealize heroic male violence, do not reflect the human psyche, but rather the dominator psyche. The same psyche that threatens all life on this planet. Looking at psychology from a gender perspective, we would recognize something that is quite obvious, that men, like women, need close, loving bonds with both women and men, including both their mothers and their fathers.
I'm so glad you read that. This is an inclusive model. This is not a model, the partnership model of saying men are bad and women are good. It's a model to reclaim our full humanity for both women and men. And of course, that's really what so many people today are engaged in, aren't we? We're deconstructing the domination model, and we are reconstructing ourselves. We're reinventing ourselves. But it's not enough to reinvent ourselves. We also have to reinvent the larger culture, institutions, the beliefs.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Are hurting all around you, who are suffering and starving and aching and dying, and they are.